You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koto katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. E whaakine coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Labour's Shannon Halbert about university funding shortfalls, the living wage rise and the default KiwiSaver contribution rate increasing. And I spoke to Aaron Gilbert, Professor of Finance and Associate Dean Research at Auckland University of Technology, about the minimum KiwiSaver contribution rate increasing. For City Counselling this week, News Director Castor spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about the second round of changes to PC 120 and about the Council's disagreements with central government over fuel crisis support. Producer Pranuja spoke to Gihan Gunasekara, Professor of Commercial Law at the University of Auckland Business School, on the new Policing Amendment Bill. He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai dāne, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka awa e wariwari e hiana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano, he pakeheri rukiruki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho, me Heidi Key, 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95bfm.com. Text in your thoughts on Numa Toru Ima Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The Tertiary Education Commission does not have enough funding for all student enrolments, meaning they're carrying unsubsidised domestic students. Auckland University says 5% of their students were not subsidised and had to have funding topped up by the university. The living wage is increasing by 95 cents to $29.90. The living wage is calculated independently and released by Living Wage Aotearoa NZ. And from yesterday, the default rate for KiwiSaver contributions from both employers and employees has increased by 0.5% to 3.5%. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I asked MP Shannon Halbert about all of these issues. I started by asking about his response to universities not receiving enough government subsidies to cover all students.
Well, we know that the tertiary system has been struggling for funding for over a decade. When we were in government, we put an increase in of 4%, and we made a commitment to review the funding situation and for universities in particular. When the national government took over, they cancelled both of those initiatives, and so for the second year running, they haven't allocated enough money to support the students to study at a high time of unemployment.
Should universities be prioritising admission to subjects based on government priorities?
When we see such high unemployment at the moment, that is a time where people, and particularly young people, choose to upskill and study. The government should be taking action to make that provision available and to fund universities to support students who wish to study. But the only action that this government has taken has been to increase student fees by 6%.
Does all of this speak to a need for reform in our tertiary sector models?
Absolutely. I've always believed that higher education should be available for everyone. And the consequence of this government's decisions or inaction around addressing the funding shortfall is that less people are able to upskill and study. We see the highest number of NEETs rates, 93,000 young people not engaged in education and employment. We see universities having to self-fund something that the government should be funding. So it's really disappointing overall that the government is just sitting idle on this.
And I want to switch now to asking about the living wage increase. Does this show that more support is needed for workers?
Absolutely. This is a rollover of what government should be funding. This is something that happens every year on the 1st of April. But it's what I've heard is that people are falling short of paying for the challenges and the cost of living crisis. And this government and Christopher Luxon haven't stepped up to address those needs.
Are you at all concerned that the living wage increase was double the minimum wage increase?
Well, we know that it needs to keep up with inflation. The commitment from this government has fallen short on that, and there's no leadership from Christopher Luxon.
Overall, do more employers need to be paying their staff a living wage?
Well, it's important that we lift wages overall, yes, definitely. We know that the cost of living has increased overall over the past few years. This government needs to support that and really acknowledge that that need is there.
There's also an inequity element to this. You've mentioned young people, also Māori and Pacific communities, are more likely to be paid less. Do you think this is especially prevalent at the moment with the fuel crisis?
Well, we're seeing Māori and Pacific numbers increase in the unemployment statistics under this government. We know that that's a huge challenge and the government needs to respond to that.
And I want to switch now to ask about the KiwiSaver contribution rates changing. Are you supportive of the default rate for contributions increasing?
Yes, we support the minimum KiwiSaver contributions increasing. But clearly what we're seeing is that wages aren't keeping up with rising costs. And that's the thing that Prime Minister Christopher Luxon really needs to step up and address.
Do you think this increase reflects an underlying assumption that people are just choosing not to save rather than not being able to afford to save?
I think it's clear why it's gone up. People are struggling to afford the basics at the moment. And this was well before the fuel crisis. Under National, it has got worse. And under this fuel crisis, you know, it's got even harder for people.
In Australia, employer contributions are compulsory regardless of employee contributions. Should we follow a model more like this?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that, and the government has the tools available to them at the moment to be able to make those decisions. But what we aren't seeing is any real action that makes a difference from this government to help people to invest in their future. To increase wages, to address the cost of living challenges that they have at the moment.
And how concerned are you in general that there are so many New Zealanders who are not able to afford retirement?
A number of people are speaking to me about the cost of living challenges. I worry that the retirement savings for the average New Zealander isn't top of mind at the moment. We're trying to get by here today. But we need to invest and plan for our future and make sure that we do have those savings in place.
That was Labor's Shannon Halbert about university funding shortfalls, the living wage rise and the default KiwiSaver contribution rate increasing.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Councilling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
This week, the government announced another plan change to Plan Change 120, Auckland's plan for future housing developments across the city. Originally, the plan proposed a minimum housing capacity of 2 million, but many in central suburbs raised concerns that intensification could harm the character of their neighbourhoods. In February, the government lowered the minimum capacity to 1.6 million, which Auckland Council and Mayor spoke out against. Despite the disagreement, Council developed new plans for 1.6 million capacity. This week, however, the government announced plans to lower the minimum capacity further to 1.4 million, forcing Council to make further changes to the plans. Also, these past few weeks, we've seen disagreements between the government and council over how to best manage the fuel crisis. The government has focused on payouts to middle and lower class families with children, but Mayor Wayne Brown says a better solution could involve subsidising public transport. To discuss each of these issues, News Director Castor spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry.
We've seen some changes announced by the government, or it's changes pushed by the government in February. And we've seen another set of changes pushed this past week. What's Council's, I guess, take on this? The government continually making changes to a plan that seems largely targeted at Auckland. Is it, you know, is it important for the government to be interfering in this?
I think the first thing to know is that this is a plan that determines the future of Auckland's housing and development. So it's about saying, it's about firstly acknowledging that we need more housing in the city and that we need to put it close to jobs and services and education, close to access to strong public transport networks, like the new investment that's just about to open in the city rail links, right? So those are the principles from which the whole plan discussion started, in fact, back in about 2021 with the previous government. And what we've had since then is a series of interventions from central government, which have directed Auckland as a council, because we have to own and deliver this plan, right? They've directed Auckland Council to go particular ways to achieve those overall outcomes of more housing in a way that's better for people to be able to access what they need close by where they live, right? And the latest intervention, which I found out about yesterday, is a bit of a surprise, because we had been heading in a direction from the legislation that the current government passed in, I think it was either August or September last year, which feels like a very long time ago, but is actually not. And they passed legislation that said, we want you to make sure there's at least 2 million extra theoretical dwelling homes allowed by the plan, right? And they set up some rules for us around that as well, about where they wanted more housing and that kind of stuff. So we produced a proposal on a very, very tight time frame and went out to public submissions. People had made those submissions, 10,500 of them, which everyone had to do by Christmas, by the 19th of December. And at that stage, everybody was working on the basis we were heading towards the 2 million figure, right? And then in January, government started to get cold feet about it. We didn't really know about that until February, when they started openly talking about, instead of it being a 2 million figure, a figure of 1.6, which is quite a lot lower than 2. So then we started working in good faith on the basis that we were working to a new figure of 1.6. Then we passed some principles, which they asked us to pass, for where we would prioritise reducing housing. And we started work on that, and we've been looking at, okay, do we reduce it here, do we reduce it there? Early days of that discussion. And then, surprise, they yesterday told us, no, it's not going to be 1.6, it's going to be 1.4. So we've had three different targets in 3 months. And I'm really aware, it's now April. Will we get another target this month? I really hope not, because we all need some certainty and consistency. People have made submissions based on the 2 million target and the plan that was put up then. And the further we get away from what was notified and submitted on, the less fair that is to Aucklanders having a proper say, and the less we can as a council deliver a really good comprehensive plan that actually works. Because while they're making these big changes to big parts of what we have to do, they are not changing the timeframe that we have to do it in.
And you mentioned that the drop down to 1.6 million was a big jump down from 2 million. And we've seen this jump also down to, again, 1.4 million. What does that look like in terms of material plan development? What do these numbers mean in practice? And what kind of work, what kind of changes will we be seeing in the plan now that the scope has changed?
Changed again. I just need to rub that in because it's a very sore point. So what we had started discussing was the idea that, for example, one of the things that informed where we put more housing for the 2 million target was we looked at the most patronised and frequent bus routes across the region, right? And we took, if I remember correctly, I think it's about the top 24 or 25 of those, and on the map, put in more housing around those bus routes on the principle that that would be somewhere where you want to put more housing because the people who live there will be able to access public transport, good, frequent, rapid transit that will give them options. They don't necessarily have to own a car to participate. They'll be able to access what they need, right? And so now what we were talking about when we were talking about 1.6 was, okay, instead of looking at the top 24 or 25, maybe we look at the top 20 instead, and we reduce the increased housing allowed around those bottom ones. So with that, those kinds of things, and we had a range of things that started to us to sort of test our interest around those kinds of ideas. So similar with some of the smaller town centres, do we go, okay, instead of saying you could go up to six stories around these smaller town centres that have less services and are less connected to transport routes, you know, we carve off the bottom 10 of those, that kind of thing, right? And so still keeping the overall principle. But the other thing that hasn't really fully come out yet, and we haven't had a briefing on this yet, so this news broke yesterday, and all day yesterday until 7 p.m. last night, councillors were in a big meeting deciding a number of big issues like the future of Western Springs Stadium. And so we've had no time for staff to even prepare, because a lot of the senior staff who would prepare this information and brief us were in that meeting. We've had no time to actually debrief. So I'm going a little bit off the vibes here. But what they've told us we have to do is now it's a 1.4 target, but also we have to give an effect to what's called the National Policy Statement on Urban Development, which requires us to increase housing around those rapid transit networks, around town centres, those kinds of train stations, that kind of stuff. And it's likely that to comply with that national policy statement, we would actually have got pretty close to 1.6 anyway. We might have fallen a little bit short, but actually we can't, on the one hand, come down to 1.4 million and on the other hand meet this national policy statement, because if we do the national policy statement we'll end up with a higher number of dwellings than the 1.4. We can go higher than 1.4, but politically that's going to be really difficult now that they've lowered the target. So it's really messy. Like, it was messy already, and what keeps happening in this process is they make it really messy and hard for us. They give us no resources to do this. They give us stupid, ridiculous timeframes. And then somehow we make it work as best we can, and then they change things again. And it's incredibly frustrating. Normally, plans like this are slowly and carefully worked through with several rounds of consultation by a council. And so the overreach into our area of expertise and power when they don't really understand, which I think is what's driving some of the changes and the ridiculous timelines, they don't really understand it. They don't understand how this stuff works. And as a result, they're passing laws that put completely unreasonable expectations on the council.
I also wanted to talk about the fuel crisis and the national response to the fuel crisis. We've seen council, especially the Mayor, Wayne Brown, criticising the government for providing people with bonus money as opposed to subsidising public transport. What are the council's thoughts on this? How could the government, I guess, be better supporting Auckland in particular in reducing our fuel consumption and providing people with support as prices continue to go up?
I think the Mayor's totally right on this one. I think that if government were serious about supporting individual people but also the city and the function of the city as a place of community and economy, they would be putting more resources into supporting public transport and making that a more viable option for people instead of having to drive. It's disappointing. They've made a number of cuts to various programs and investments that were helping us to decarbonise. So, for example, getting rid of the clean car discount. Those were moves that, you know, had they continued on, we would be, as a country but also as a city, much less vulnerable now. But we can't suddenly start doing those things again when the situation is acute like this. I hope they do start doing those things again, but in terms of the current crisis, We know that we need to do mode shift anyway, because that's how we will address our carbon emissions. It's also much fairer for people, people who can't drive, for example, people who could never afford to run a car, even if fuel was cheaper than it is now, those kinds of things. So there's an equity issue there around that public transport gives people options that cars don't always. So, the idea that we give a small number of people $50 a week, and I would say there's actually a real risk that will become inflationary too, in terms of the petrol companies will know, quite a lot of people in what the government referred to as the squeezed middle now have this $50 extra. We don't need to be quite so competitive on the price of petrol. I don't know, I'm no big city economist, but I would have thought there's a risk there. It really worries me that the government package, which I think is directed incorrectly, it's $300+ million. They could easily have put that into public transport, would have made a huge difference in terms of subsidy. But also it's missing a whole lot of people. It's missing students, your community. And I really liked the, I can't remember what it's called, but I think it's the fuel crisis package or something that AUSA and the AUT Students Association have put out, saying, let's make public transport free. I'd love it if we did that eventually anyway. So why don't we try it and see what happens? But that will need government funding, and it will need the government to allow us to change what's called the farebox recovery percentage, which is basically the amount of money that council brings in from public transport fares. So we can't do that on our own. We actually need permission from central government to get less income from fares, and we need the subsidy to actually pay for the public.
That was Auckland Councillor Julie Ferry speaking to News Director Castor about the second round of PC 120 changes and disagreements over how to provide support amidst the fuel crisis.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Councilling on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B and text in your thoughts 5395.
Add some spice to your existential crises with the new Robin Records Sexistential. It's so good, we've made it our album of the week. And that means if you have a B card, you can win a copy on 95BFM Breakfast all week. Just tune in for your cue to enter.
Sexistential, the new album from Robin. Available Friday, March 27th, wherever fine music is sold.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
Hey, you might want to sort that Muppet out.
What's wrong with my Muppet?
Well, Sarah's going to be here on Saturday.
Sarah's coming? You didn't tell me Sarah was coming. She can't see this dreary Muppet.
Yeah, those bass lines are drooping as well.
Fluff your Muppets and slip, slop, slap up your bass lines. It's Saturday afternoons with Sarah. Sarah.
Saturday afternoons with Sarah, 2 to 4pm every Saturday, only on 95 BFM, thanks to Decibel Wines.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
I can't say that I'm sorry when
I don't feel so wrong anymore. I can't tell you I'm trying when there's nothing left here to try for. And I don't know how it happened. We both abandoned the reason we used to believe. Was it love that we shared when we easily cared? Now it's impossible to conceive. I don't know who can see you if you've ever learned how. Would it bring us together again? I can't say that I'm sorry when I don't feel so wrong anymore. I can't tell.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
A new law change known as the Policing Amendment Bill is raising concerns about privacy and police powers in Aotearoa. The bill would give police expanded powers, including the ability to record and retain short-lived videos in public. Supporters say it will help police respond more effectively to crime, but critics are worried the rules are too vague, with a low threshold for collecting personal information and not enough safeguards around how the data is used or stored. There are also concerns that the changes could disproportionately affect Māori and young people. I spoke to Jihan Gunasekara, Professor of Commercial Law at the University of Auckland Business School, about what this could mean for everyday New Zealanders.
For listeners who might not have seen the bill yet, what would the Policing Amendment Bill actually allow the police to do?
Okay, so a bit of context here is needed. The police, of course, collect a lot of information as they go about their daily tasks, and they have powers that are given to them under the Policing Act. They can generally take photographs of individuals. They can ask for their details, but individuals have certain rights. Most people are probably not aware of the fact you don't have to give your name to the police if they ask you for it. Only if you're the driver of a car that's stopped, then under the Land Transport Act, you have to identify yourself. But people generally don't have to, but it generally, convention is that people will answer questions to the police, but not any further questions without being given a reason for that. But the police have these powers, but they generally, if they take photographs of people, they can only be used if the person is being charged with an offence. And if the person is discharged without an offence going ahead, they are required currently in the Policing Act to delete any images that they take. So that's the background to this. So there was a case last year in the Supreme Court of New Zealand called Tamiefuna. And that case, an individual was photographed and their identity and their image were held on a police intelligence database and then subsequently used when a criminal prosecution was brought. But at the time the photograph was taken, it wasn't in relation to a specific offence. It was just a general photograph, a background photograph that was taken. And the Supreme Court said that the police were not entitled to have that image because the Policing Act didn't allow them to retain it, unless, of course, at the time he had been charged with an offence. So that's the background for this. The government wasn't happy with that decision. There was also, a couple of years ago, a joint inquiry by the Independent Police Complaints Authority and the Privacy Commissioner that looked into the photographing of rangatahi, Māori youth, and it was found that there were disproportionate images being taken of Māori youth who were not necessarily committing any offence, but just for the police, their kind of policing functions, and the police were asked to delete all those images. So I suspect the government wasn't happy with that decision. So the Policing Amendment Act now allows the police to basically do all of those above mentioned things, take pictures of people as they wish and retain them. So it's a bit of a long-winded answer, but that's the context.
You've said the privacy implications are huge for this bill. What are your main concerns from your perspective?
So people will now be surveilled by the police, and you could be at a pop concert, you could be at a some kind of religious commemoration, you could be at a pride parade, you could be on any number of things. The police can take photographs. Now, you know, obviously anyone can take photographs generally, but the difference is that the police photographs could subsequently be used, perhaps years from now, to then profile somebody to say, oh yeah, you were seen with that person or that other person. And we don't know what other softwares are being used by the police to match and profile individuals. And remember, we have biometric identification technologies now that weren't available a few years ago. So the police can take photographs and videos in many contexts and retain it on their databases. And we don't really know how long they can keep it. There's no strict rules around how long they can keep that information. And the other concern I have is, are people going to be allowed to access that data under the Privacy Act? The Privacy Act allows everybody to find out what information is held about them. So these are questions I will be asking, and I'll be asking the Select Committee, and I'll be making a submission on this. But I encourage members of the public to do the same. They should ask, well, you know, are we going to be able to access the information the police has collected about us? There are, of course, exceptions where there's a current law enforcement in investigation or something like that, but there's no general rule that stops the police. That allows the police to withhold that kind of information. They have to point to a specific law maintenance inquiry or function that they are currently carrying out. They can't generally say, well, this is off limits, we don't have to give you this information. No, they have to give you that information. So these are the questions, the serious privacy questions that I think people need to ask.
The bill allows recording if police believe it's justified. Is this threshold clear enough, or does it leave too much room for interpretation?
Again, the whole bill leaves a lot of room for interpretation. The police have virtually unlimited discretion here. The functions that they're allowed to collect information for the general police functions, which at the moment people can look them up, they're in Section 9 of the Policing Act 2008, and they are very, very broad, keeping the peace, maintaining public safety, law enforcement, community support and reassurance. Some of these things could actually be, they could be counterintuitive because, you know, one of the ways you maintain community support is by bringing the community along with you. But if you surveil particular groups, for example, or ethnicities or socioeconomic groups, and you tend to, you know, they feel that they are being watched and surveilled, that could have a counter purpose to, you know, actually promoting good policing. Good policing is about what's called policing by consent, where you bring the community along with you. You don't intimidate them. You don't use surveillance as a technique to put a chill on people. I mean, the other serious implications for this is when it comes to the right to protest. You know, there are some people who are very active demonstrators or protesters, and sometimes that will involve acts of civil disobedience. Now, obviously, the police will not be happy with that, but we live in a democratic society where we have the right to protest. People will have seen, you know, what happened in the United States with the ICE agents, and, you know, people could do things like blocking a road with their vehicle or something like that. In the context of a protest, some of those actions may be justifiable. But if the police can increasingly take images and videos of people, that might think, you know, people might think, well, I better not join this because I might be photographed or videoed. That is putting a chill on free speech, and I would argue that we should resist that in New Zealand.
You've also mentioned the risk of certain groups being overrepresented. How could this policy contribute to that?
Well, let me give you a very clear example. So let's say there are two groups of people. We won't say white and black. Let's say there's two groups. We'll label them orange and green, just to be neutral. Okay. So let's say there's one group of orange individuals and another group of green individuals. Now, if the police, for whatever reason, tend to take twice as many photographs of the green group and not the orange group, and they retain those photographs, just under the law of probability, there will be more convictions of people who are in the green group, just because of, you know, not because they're more likely to commit a crime, but because more of their images are held. And so you get the point where people will say, oh, well, they are more likely to commit an offense. Well, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because the data set that you've used is already biased in favor of one group. So this is the risk that I see with this kind of police profiling. It allows way too much discretion to the police. It simply says, trust us. And we know from past inquiries, there have been objective studies of this done in New Zealand and in other countries where it has been proved scientifically that there is inherent bias in the way some of these organizations operate, not for any malicious reason, but simply the cultural context of the way that these organizations function. There is naturally a bias against certain groups. And so the risk is that you will lead to further alienation of those groups, and that's the other real fear that I have. Leaving aside the fear that these images and other data regarding, you know, who people are associating with, we don't know what records will be retained for how long. Somebody could apply for a job 10 years later, and the police, of course, do job vetting. Are they going to release some of those out-of-date bits of information that might have, you know, they might have at one time suspected somebody of being a criminal associate, but, you know, they may never have committed any offense and there was never any prosecution brought. Well, that data should be deleted in that case. But there's case law in New Zealand that it's very difficult to require police to delete data once they have it.
What kind of safeguards or protections would need to be in place for something like this to work without compromising on people's rights?
Well, I'll give you a couple of very clear, this is what I'm going to say in my submission. It needs to be made very clear that the Privacy Act continues to operate, that this legislation does not in any way override or diminish the rights that are in the Privacy Act. That needs to be made very clear in the law. Also, people should then have the right to exercise their rights under the Privacy Act to ask for access to their information. And the last thing is, I think we need to have some kind of audit to make sure that this information is deleted when it is no longer required. And there needs to be periodic audits to see that police aren't retaining vast amounts of information, as turned out to be the case with the Rangatahi inquiry a few years ago with the Independent Police Complaints Authority and the joint investigation with the Privacy Commissioner, where they found that there were thousands and thousands of images of youth, and they were retained across multiple devices, and then police, in fact, didn't know how many they had. And when they were required to delete them, they said, we don't know how to do that because they're all over the place. So are the police going to be required to maintain any of the information and the images, especially biometric data that they collect? I mean, are they going to be required to maintain them on a central database that is accessible and where the Privacy Commissioner and other regulators can check to see that that information is not being misused?
And finally, what's one thing you think people should be paying attention to as this bill moves forward?
Well, there's a number of things, but I think the what I've just mentioned is the critical factor. People need to know, can they exercise their rights, their privacy rights, to find out why the information is being held, and also can they ask for a right of deletion? I think that's, we don't have a right of deletion in New Zealand, and I think people should be pushing for that.
That was producer Pranusha speaking to Professor Jihan Gunasekara on the new policing amendment bill.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
We'll be right back. This is The Forest from Princess Chelsea.
Just get strong, so I run.
just get strong. So I run.
If you want to save money and health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
As of yesterday, the minimum rate for KiwiSaver contributions for both employers and employees has increased to 3.5%, while contributions are also set to increase to 4% in 2028, this still won't be enough for most New Zealanders to retire on. Currently, about 1.5 million people do not contribute to KiwiSaver, and 65% of those who do contribute only provide the bare minimum they can. I spoke to Aaron Gilbert, Professor of Finance and Associate Dean Research at the Auckland University of Technology, about this increase and the flaws in KiwiSaver that stop people from saving more. I started by asking if he could outline the change to KiwiSaver.
On 1 April, they've changed the contribution rate. So now employees and employers, the default contribution rate is 3.5%, and this is one of two planned increases. So in 2 years' time, it'll increase to 4% each from employers and employees.
And what is the logic to these changes?
There's plenty of good evidence to suggest that KiwiSaver balances at the moment aren't growing the way that we need them to get people to retirement with enough money to be comfortable. And so one way to fix that is to have people contribute extra into their KiwiSaver on an ongoing basis. That extra 0.5% realistically could wind up amounting to tens of thousands of dollars by the time that someone hits retirement.
So why do you think this change is then potentially problematic?
Because KiwiSaver has a couple of big problems in terms of meeting its overall goal of preparing Kiwis for retirement. One of them is the fact that we have already over 1 million people who are members of KiwiSaver but aren't contributing. The other problem that we have is that it is unfortunately those who probably need KiwiSaver the most who are likely to be struggling with the cost of KiwiSaver. And if you're having to make a choice between whether you put food on the table today or whether you hit retirement in 20 or 30 years with enough money to be somewhat comfortable, I think a lot of people are going to be making a choice about today. So while it is great that we're starting to have the discussion about contributions, and I think it's going to work for a lot of people, we have to be really mindful that in a really high cost living environment that we don't push people out of making any contributions to their KiwiSaver. The other problem we have is that because we've tied employer and employee contributions together, we've created an all or nothing system. So if someone feels that they can't afford the extra 0.5% coming out of their income, then they also don't benefit from their from an increase in their employer's contribution. So rather than being somewhat better off, they're just going to lose all of that benefit.
But is there an alternative way to structure our superannuation scheme, or maybe a different model that we could look to mitigate these issues?
Well, Australia, who we like to compare ourselves to in numerous settings, they don't link employer and employee contributions. And in fact, they put a lot of the burden on the employer for retirement savings. So over in Australia, for instance, the employer contribution is about 12% at the moment. Compare that with New Zealand, where in 2 years' time we will be at 4%. But they also don't link employee and employer contributions. So basically, if you feel that you can't afford to contribute, you still get the benefit from your employer.
And is there anything else you'd want people to know about these KiwiSaver changes?
I think a lot of people don't realise the impact that small changes can have on their KiwiSaver. And so while people are rightly making choices, if you're in a situation where you have to make a choice between surviving today and being better off in your retirement, I fully understand people having to make that choice. I think the big thing, though, for other people is KiwiSaver, small changes matter. That extra 0.5% is tens of thousands of dollars at retirement. Making sure that you're in the right type of fund, that makes huge impacts by the time that you get to retirement. So I think my big thing would be that people really need to be aware of the consequences of the decisions that they make around their KiwiSaver, particularly in the longer frame.
That was Aaron Gilbert, Professor of Finance, Associate Dean Research at Auckland University of Technology, on the minimum KiwiSaver contribution rate increasing.
children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Councillor Julie Ferry, University of Auckland's Jihan Gunasekera, and Auckland University of Technology's Aaron Gilbert. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.